are going to finish up with the Covenanters this evening. Actually, it'll probably be a short time because we made so much progress last time. We got through the rest of that history. Then we got through Patrick Hamilton, Andrew Melville, Samuel Rutherford, the tragic Archibald Campbell, Marquess of Argyll, and we got through James Guthrie and his cousin William last time. And that brings us to the last two, and then I'll have a few closing remarks as well. We'll pick up then now with John Brown of Priest Hill, who, not exactly sure of his birth, but his death was in 1685. And where so many of these others that we've talked about so far are known for their eminence in learning or in preaching or political leadership or some such thing, John Brown of Priest Hill was a common covenanter. And that's one reason I introduce you to him here. The significant persecutions of this time were not just felt by the great men in the public eye. They were also felt by common everyday people, covenanters who simply wished to obey God and to worship Him according to their consciences. And John was one such common man. He was a carrier, kind of a 17th century UPS man, and he was well trusted for his faithfulness and his diligence. He was poor. He and his wife Isabel never had more than 20 sheep and a cow on their little Priest Hill homestead. We don't know a great deal about his first wife, who died while their daughter Janet was still very young, but then he married Isabel Weir on a bright April morning in 1682. Alexander Payden, called the Prophet of the Covenant, we're not going to deal with him specifically, but I'll give you some references, and he's certainly well worth the time to get acquainted with him, Alexander Payden. He's the one who conducted the ceremony. And he came up to Isabel there in the open glen, and he told her on her wedding day, "You have a good husband, Isabel. Value him highly. But keep linen for a winding sheet beside you. For in a day when you least expect it, thy master will be taken from thy head. But fear not, thou shalt be comforted." Gloomy words for a wedding day. But he was right. And in her heart she knew it. Alexander Payden was gifted with an unusual insight to be able to see how the course of events would likely play out, and one reason he's called the Prophet of the Covenant. Well, John knew his doctrine well enough to instruct the youths of the county in the Bible and in the catechisms, but he but he had a bad stammer. And so he did not feel called to preach because of the deficiency in his speech. Well, they often entertained strangers in their home, and poor as they were, they would gladly share with those in need. Their home was like a haven to poor covenanters. And then came that fateful morning, 1st of May, 1685. And this was at the height of the killing times that we spoke of last time, when men hunted down covenanters as if they were so many game animals. You remember a common soldier had the authority to kill, to shoot, and to kill a suspect without trial, and they did. Well, after their usual morning worship, John went with his nephew up on the hill to cut some peat. They were then surprised by a troop of dragoons led by John Graham of Claverhouse, the Viscount of Dundee. Well, they tried to run, but they were quickly caught. Claverhouse made sport of John's nephew and then sent him away to be hanged. And John, they brought back to his cottage. Now, let me tell you just a little bit about this fellow, Claverhouse, John Graham of Claverhouse, the Viscount of Dundee. He's immortalized in our folk ballad as Bonnie Dundee. You know, the handsome cavalier riding gaily about the countryside looking for adventure, Bonnie Dundee. Actually, he was a bloodthirsty, cruel, heartless man who lived with one purpose, to kill Covenanters. On his own wedding day, Claverhouse heard that there was a group of Covenanters meeting in a certain place, and so he left his bride at the altar, postponed his honeymoon for 2 weeks, and rode off at the head of a troop of dragoons to kill Covenanters. That's your Bonnie Dundee. Even after the Glorious Revolution, 1688, when William and Mary's on the throne and the church is restored to a great measure of freedom and liberty from persecution, Dundee still led an armed insurrection and uprising, trying to throw off the new king and bring back James II. He failed, of course, fortunately. Well, Claverhouse, also known as Bloody Clavers, had come to the garrison at Les Mahago the night before, and he had heard that Alexander Payton was at John Brown's house. Now, he had this obsession to get Payton. Well, Clavers was bent on killing Mr. Payton, and he set out with dragoons to Priest Hill. And Mr. Payton had indeed been at Priest Hill, but he left before sunrise that morning. Before he left, he told them, "It is a fearful morning, a dark, misty morning." And they could all feel the foreshadowing of doom. Well, little Janet was 8 now, and she ran to tell Isabel that there were a great many horsemen coming down the hill with her daddy. Isabel picked up their infant son. She was pregnant with another, and she went out to find Claverhouse yelling at John in front of the cottage. And he asked him why he did not attend the curate, and would he pray for the king? Remember those two key things in the covenanting struggle. Everyone was by law required to attend the curate, that is, the stated meetings of the now corrupted state church, and this the covenanters could not do in good conscience. Well, John answered Claverhouse, and Isabel was amazed, because John's stammer disappeared completely. No more stuttering, no fumbling over words, no stumbling over words. He gave plain yet eloquent answer for his faith. He calmly explained that he could not attend the curates because they are placed there contrary to Christ's law, and they are mere creatures of the bishops. And the bishops were appointed by the king, who is a papist. And the whole nation swore and covenanted together that no papist would ever rule Scotland. As for praying for the king, of course John prayed for the king. But what Clavers wanted was for John to pray for the king as head of the kirk. And John explained that Jesus Christ is the only head of the kirk, that the king is not the head of the kirk or the church. Well, Claverhouse grew very angry, and he could take this no longer. He said, "Go to your prayers," he told John, "for you shall immediately die." And John knelt, and he prayed, and the troops that were with him were visibly moved. But Claverhouse paced the ground and cursed and shouted. "I gave you leave to pray," he said, "and you've begun to preach." And John simply looked up at him and said, "You know nothing of true praying or of true preaching that callest this preaching." Well, John and Isabel were exchanging their last tender words. She assured him that he was right to be faithful, and she was willing in God's providence to part with him. He was comforted by this, and he kissed Isabel and wee Janet and their baby boy. And he said to Janet, "My sweet bairn, give your hand to God as your guide, and be your mother's comfort." Well, even before he was finished with his last words, Claverhouse ordered 6 dragoons to raise their muskets and fire. But John's prayer had so affected the men that they couldn't bring themselves to shoot him. and they lowered their muskets. And then Claverhouse, who thought nothing of human life, walked up and pulled his own pistol from his belt and blew John's brains all over the field. His troops went away amazed. But Claverhouse stayed to gloat. Well, Isabel knelt down to gather her husband's shattered head as best she could. He laughed at her. He said, "Now, what thinkest thou of thy fine husband now, woman?" "I always thought much good of him," she answered, "and never more than now." And he snarled back, "It were but justice to lay thee beside him." "If he were permitted," she told him, "I doubt not your cruelty would go that length. But how will you answer for this morning's work?" "To men I can be answerable," he told her, "and as for God, I will take him into my own hands." Then he rode off, leaving her in her tears. She put John's head back as best she could. She laid his body in order, covered it with her plaid. She gathered her children beside her. She sat on the ground beside his body, and she cried. That's where she was found later by her neighbors who helped her prepare John's body for burial. She had kept linen as a winding sheet, as Alexander Payton had told her to, and now she had opportunity to use it. They had their evening devotions following their usual schedule, which brought them in Providence to the poignant passage of John 17, and then the rest of that morning's versified psalm that they were reading for that day. "And now, even at this present time, mine head shall lifted be above all those that are my foes and round encompass me. Therefore unto his tabernacle I'll sacrifices bring, of joyfulness I'll sing, yea, I to God will praises sing." John Brown was a common man. He didn't lead great congregations like Alexander Payton. He didn't lead armed men like Richard Cameron. He didn't cross the king like Archibald Campbell or Andrew Melville. He was a simple man who, along with his wife, simply tried to live a godly life as best they could and worship God in the freedom of Puritan simplicity. There were many other plain, ordinary men like him who also paid for their faithfulness with their lives. Covenant College, some years ago now, kind of redid their health services department, and they were looking for a name. "What do you call this new place?" And they asked for suggestions, and I said, What you could really call it is the Priest Hill Center, because the home of John Brown and his wife at Priest Hill was a haven and a refuge where Alexander Payton and so many others would come through and would receive hospitality and strength and encouragement in their walk before the Lord. And so they did. You go up there today, it's the Priest Hill Center of Health Services. And that brings us then to, I have the time, let me digress. Twice, I think, I did this. Took a, back in the old days, sometimes they would ask me to do chapels at Covenant College. And, One year I took a covenant student and had her take the role of Isabel Brown of Priest Hill. And it was like a visit in her little cottage. And so we had recreated the little cottage, and there she was, and I came and led the chapel folks into her living room to hear her very simple, plain, yet incredibly powerful testimony of God's faithfulness to her in the loss of her husband for the sake of Jesus Christ and for the cause of Christ against the rulers of Scotland. And I will never forget the it was one of the most powerful chapels that I remember, simply because of this plain covenanter's testimony that we were able to glimpse there that morning. Well, that brings us to James Renwick, spelled Renwick, and of course I learned all this from Dr. Tate, being British, who pronounces it Renwick. His dates are 1662, the year of the Great Ejection, and he died in 1688, and he was the last of the Covenanter martyrs. James was raised in the heart of Covenanter country, near the village of Monieve in Nithsdale. His parents, Andrew and Elizabeth, were weavers, godly Christians. He began at a very early age to pray and to read the scriptures. He was gifted with a very tender conscience and an acute spiritual sensitivity for one of his youth. He studied at the University of Edinburgh and was deeply moved by his experiences there. While there, he stood beneath the scaffold where Donald Cargill was martyred. And at that point, he was so deeply moved that he decided to join the Cameronian hill folk, those followers of Richard Cameron who were hunted down so fiercely by Charles and James, and yet who still, in God's providence, eluded them for such a long time. He qualified for his Master of Arts degree at the university, but he refused to accept it because he would have been required to take the oath of allegiance. Everyone who was to have a position of authority was required to swear this oath of allegiance, which in effect gave the king absolute power. And in good conscience, James Renwick could not take that oath and say, as everyone else said, "I acknowledge my said sovereign only supreme governor of this kingdom over all persons and in all cases. I shall never decline his majesty's power and jurisdiction as I shall answer to God." Well, since he could not subscribe to that oath, he forfeited his degree, choosing rather to cast in his lot with a group of wandering covenanters. The Cameronians needed ministers badly, most of them having by now been killed off. So they sent James and six others over to the Netherlands for further study. He studied under John Amark at Groningen University, who in 6 months recommended him for ordination. Shortly, he was back in his native Scotland, where he ministered in the persecuted Kirk for four short but very remarkable years. He was president. He was present at the General Assembly of the United Societies on October 3rd, 1683, where he was examined and called as their minister. The United Societies were those fellowship societies that were scattered throughout the country, still maintaining their faith, their fidelity to the covenants. He was soon labeled by the authorities James Renwick, Field Preacher, Rebel, Vagrant. When he would preach, it would always be with a fast horse standing ready in case he had to escape the authorities. And in those 4 years, he never rested from preaching, teaching, organizing, drawing up papers and documents and declarations, counseling, whatever was needed to shepherd his scattered flock. He had many, many narrow escapes from the hunting dragoons. In all of this time, he ruined his health, and he would at times be troubled with fainting spells and other health issues. Then one winter night in Edinburgh, he was caught. He was badly hurt in the scuffle, and he was put in chains. He was examined several times and asked to give information about the societies, which he refused. He was asked to recant, which he refused. He was asked to recognize the supreme authority of the king, which he refused. His inquisitor asked him, "How can you deny him to be the king?" James II. "Is he not the late king's brother? Has the late king any children lawfully begotten? Is James not successor to Charles by act of parliament? And he answered these questions very plainly. And he demonstrated that by the law, it could not be demonstrated that James had the right to the title. And then concerning the question of the heirs of Charles, he said, what children he had, I do not know. The cruel truth was that of his children unlawfully begotten, there were 13 that we know of who grew to adulthood. And Mr. Rennick was, of course, condemned to be hanged. The day of his execution was 3 days after his 26th birthday. His mother was quite distressed at losing her son, and he was able to speak comfort to her in his last hours. On the scaffold before they hanged him, he prayed, Lord, I die in faith that thou wilt not leave Scotland, but that thou wilt make the blood of thy witnesses the seed of thy church, and return again and be glorious in our land. And he was hanged the 17th of February, 1688. Only a few months later, at the glorious revolution of 1688, the tyranny of the Stuarts would be brought to an end, essentially, as we saw with a few little death pangs afterwards, like Claverhouse and his uprising. But once that was over, the tyranny of the Stuarts was a thing of the past, thankfully never to return. These are some of the people that I have grown to know and grown to love. These are some of the people who make our heritage what it is, a heritage of courage, of faith, and blood, a heritage of the covenants. And I want to introduce you. There are people that I have not brought before you, some that I will recommend that you become acquainted with on your own. But before I do that, I want to read just a selection from this book, Fair Sunshine by Jock Purvis. There are some others I'll introduce to you in a moment. This is his epilogue, as he has brought a number of these people that we have looked at in his book, as well as some that we haven't looked at. Donald Cargill, of course, you'll want to see. Richard Cameron, I just touched in passing. You'll want to become acquainted with him. And Alexander Payden, some of these others, you'll want to be. The two Margarets, you'll want to become acquainted with some of them and their testimony for the covenants. But Purvis gives as an epilogue these words. What were their losses and what their gains? Their losses were themselves and all that they had. Their gains were great. Not for themselves, but for posterity. They, with their fellows, the Puritans, gained freedom in every realm of human living, thus winning and preserving democracy, and the right, spiritually and morally, to worship God with an open Bible interpreted by all. They were the pioneers of the Protestant intellectual renaissance, resulting in the discovery of so much for the good of man in his earth environment, accompanied by laws for the community and social ameliorations whose good can never be calculated. All byproducts of the gospel had to have a preserved gospel. They were the preservers. They made possible the lawfulness of dissent in times of error, coldness, and ecclesiastical death, cleared the way and dug the foundations of every religious revival we have since known, and were the first in the missionary enterprise. To them we owe our way of life, our constitution, our institutions, our commonwealth, and our honored place among the nations of the world. But for them, our place and that of the USA would have been low down among the Romanist nations, with the grimly attendant dire consequences of such a plight, the menace of atheistic communism. Their faith held no lifeless opinions. It was as spiritual and evangelical as they themselves were, alive to God, taken up with the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. So dear is their memory, so sure their testimony, that for us it must be, whose faith follow, considering the end of their manner of life, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. Says Jock Purvis, and I'll introduce you to this book, Fair Sunshine, which is, this is probably the first one you may want to pick up. It's written very short, brief, something you can read through in a short amount of time. And it is, as you can see, I've gone through it a little bit. I mean, this was originally done by the Banner of Truth Trust, and I suspect they probably still have that in print. I'm sure you can probably get that. And of course, straight from the horse's mouth, we talked about the Reformation in Scotland, and John Knox, here you have it, also Banner of Truth, so you can get his own words regarding that history. I'll recommend that to you. Here, Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smellie, also, it's also Banner, isn't it? Recommend that one to you. And then this comes in, well, I have it in two volumes. I think they've published it a number of times. Originally it was published as the Scots Worthies by John Howie, and old timers like Rinder and I refer to it as Howie's Worthies. It was republished by Cross under the title Lives of the Scottish Covenanters, same book. And bound in two volumes. I'm very attached to this one because this was given to me.
Republished by my uncle.
Republished by your uncle?
Yes. Oh, royalties.
Oh.
Trust.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. So that's the, I did not know that. That's another reason for me to cherish this one. Is this one still in print?
I don't know. That's the one I have.
I know they've redone it in a single volume, I think, and I don't know who. I'm also very attached to this one because these two volumes were given to me by Paul Gilchrist before he became the stated clerk of PCA, back when he was teaching Hebrew and stuff up there at Covenant College. And so this is a very much beloved volume here that I'll recommend to you as well. You can read also George Wishart and all those guys that they deal with in here. Howie's Worthies, or Lives of the Scottish Covenanters, or whatever the title is that they've got it under now. And there are probably others. Those I could lay my hands on fairly quickly to bring with me. But these are the people that I have. These are my brothers. And they're your brothers. I mean, there is a genuine kinship. I'm not just talking about the milk of human kindness that makes one man feel sympathy for another man in misery, but this is a genuine spiritual kinship that in Jesus Christ we are brothers with these who have gone before, with these who have dealt with the same issues that we deal with of truth and faithfulness to the gospel, of how to worship the Lord in the way that He prescribes, how to live a life of obedience to Him in a world that tries very much to keep you from doing that. And many of these dear brothers paid with their lives, paid with their blood, paid with all their outward goods, and had everything stripped away and taken away because of their faithfulness to Him. And so these are men worth getting to know, and I commend them to you.